lecture. I had hoped to illustrate my lecture with clips from selected films, but this proved impossible for technical reasons, but also for time constraints. I apologize, therefore, if some of what I'm saying will seem somewhat abstract and theoretical. I want to start with two definitions of documentary film, one that stresses the proximity of documentary to history and forensics. And by forensics, I mean judicial processes of providing evidence. And the other definition stresses the proximity of documentary to fiction and narrative. I shall then offer my own definition, together with a brief historical argument about both the origins and the political rationale of documentary film throughout its 80-year existence as a separate genre and a separate mode of filmmaking. I shall then outline six distinct subcategories of this mode, that is, this mode of filmmaking called documentary, in order to help you classify the many documentaries you are seeing here at the festival, but also to make the history of documentary film comprehensible also from the audience's point of view and not only from the perspective of the filmmakers. Finally, if I have time, I want to talk about three kinds of challenges that confront documentary filmmaking today. First one is institutional, namely the relation of documentary film to television, especially to the rise of television as not only a medium of news and factual programming, but as a kind of factory or industry of the real. Television as a factory or industry of the real, not only processing reality into documentary programs, but manufacturing the real through all kinds of reality TV shows, which have provided much revenue for the companies and have proved very popular with audiences. That's the first challenge, the institutional challenge. The second challenge is ideological, namely, what happens to documentary's traditional commitment to a progressive perspective on human affairs, that is, human progress, after the collapse of socialism and after the victory of the free market economy. And the third challenge is technological, namely the use of digital equipment in documentary filmmaking, at first glance perhaps almost a contradiction, accompanied by the rise of the faked documentary, or of doc-fic, or documentary fiction, or how you want to call it, reenactment, staging, all the no-nos of traditional documentary practice, which are now almost common and widely accepted. Accompanied by the rise of the internet and especially the rise of user-generated content, as on YouTube, Dailymotion, and many other web providers of content. So let me start with my two definitions. Documentary film belongs to a class of social discourses, juridical and historical, that seek to account for actual occurrences in the phenomenal world. They take as their reference events that are perceptible, that have been observed and can be located in time and space. Documentary film are constituted of documents in the sense by which this word obtains in the human science, in other words, in the way that we understand documents in the human sciences. That is, faithful representations of events that exist outside the consciousness of the documentarist. It's a little bit complicated, but it's actually quite compact in that it points out, first of all, the relationship of documentary to perceptible, the phenomenological world, that is what we can see with our eyes, along the line of to see is to know, but it also emphasizes that documentaries have very often a relationship, or want to have, or want to claim a relationship to veracity, to evidence, and therefore to truth. And I shall, in the process, show how problematic that notion is, that the real can be in any way equated with truth. So that's the first definition of a documentary. And as I said, the second one stresses more the relationship of documentary to fiction and to narrative. This is a definition by Michael Renoff from a book called Theorizing Documentary. And Michael Renoff is one of the leading English language theoreticians of documentary. This is his definition. Documentary contains any number of fictive elements, moments at which a presumably objective representation of the world encounters the necessity of creative intervention. Among these fictive ingredients, we may include the construction of a character emerging through recourse to ideal and imagined categories of hero or genius, or just protagonist, if you like. As you know, many documentaries, after they set the scene, then focus on one particular individual or a small group of individuals, which could be defined or described as the invention of a character, the invention of a protagonist. Documentaries also encompass the use of poetic language, of narration or musical accompaniment to heighten the emotional impact or to create suspense via the agency of embedded narratives. That is, documentaries very often have a narrative thread or a narrative arc, even if that is not particularly stressed. For instance, narratives, embedded narratives like tales told by interview subjects. Very often you have people, you film characters and then the documentaries say, well, is there an incident in your life that you particularly remember? In other words, you allow your protagonists to provide narrative material and a narrative arc. Or there are various dramatic curves that you build into a narrative. For instance, the classic crisis structure. In other words, very many of the documentaries from the 60s follow people at the moment of a crisis in their lives. And so crisis is a very favored way of creating a kind of pseudo-narrative. Many more examples could be offered. The use of high or low angle shots, whose effects have been conventionalized in fiction film and television and are now used for documentaries. Close-ups, which trade emotional resonance for spatial integrity. In other words, you insert a close-up, even if that close-up doesn't actually belong to that particular moment in the events that you're representing. The use of the telephoto or wide-angle lens, which squeezes or distorts space. And finally, the use of editing to make time contract, expand, or rhythmic. That's the end of my definition from Michael Renoff. So, I move to my own definition of documentary. For me, documentary is a special subcategory of the non-fiction film. And it's special insofar that it's historically locatable and formally circumscribed. And why do I insist on not equating documentary with non-fiction? Because there are other forms of non-fiction which do not qualify as documentary. For instance, in the first period of the cinema, the first 20 years of cinema, you had all kinds of genres which were called actualities, topicals, newsreels, animated views, travelogues, and so on, which are non-fiction, but they're not documentary. Likewise, throughout film history, there have been non-fiction genres such as the industrial film, the advertising films, instructional films, medical films. And more recently, we need to add to the non-fiction categories surveillance footage, all the images that come to us through surveillance cameras, webcams, guided missile footage, and other automated forms of image gathering and image storage. All this is non-fiction, but not documentary. Because the documentary occupies a very special but also circumscribed place within all this non-fiction material. I make this point as a kind of footnote because for film studies, the discipline that I represent, non-fiction material has become increasingly important both for our understanding of the 20th century, which has left so many records in images, in sound and images, which have no particular place within the canonical accounts of film history. And secondly, because more and more filmmakers now use what they call found footage. That is, they compile or make a narrative or an argument out of material which they receive from archival sources. And on average, in any national film archive, you can assume that 70 to 80% of the material that the archive holds is neither fiction film nor documentary. So the vast amount of what is stored in archives has no place yet in film history. And so the categories, the various categories of non-fiction film, are increasingly important for our understanding of the cinema. So, documentary was a relative latecomer in the history of the cinema. It was invented, and you can use the word invented, it was invented in the late 1920s by John Grierson, who was himself a filmmaker, but was far more important as an ideologue and an institutionalizer of documentary, which he defined famously as, and I quote, the creative treatment of actuality. The creative treatment of actuality, which is a brilliant formulation because it allows a filmmaker to both stress the creative side, what I call fiction and narrative, and actuality, which gets more in the direction of evidence and document. The reason that John Grierson invented documentary has to do with several specific moments at that time, the late 20s. If you like, several crises. And one of the crises was among the filmmaking avant-garde, that is, filmmakers who from the early 20s onwards, really from the end of the First World War, were using film very much in the way that they were used to using painting and music. In other words, what we know as abstract film, as experimental film, as formal film, all categories that fit neither what was then actuality nor what we know as narrative fiction film. And there was a crisis at the end of the 20s through the coming of sound. All this material, this experimental material, was usually silent. Think of the Russian, Pudovkin, Eisenstein, Kuleshov, Vertov, or think of the German Walter Ruttmann. All that is part of the avant-garde, which came into crisis in the late 20s with the coming of sound, because with the coming of sound, suddenly there was no place and no need for showing avant-garde films in the cinemas. And so inventing documentary was to invent a new category for films that were inspired by avant-garde methods and avant-garde ideology, but which now had to fight for a space in the cinema, which was no longer the traditional one. But there was also an ideological dimension. It's no accident that it was in Britain that the documentary was invented. Because Grierson, even though he was, if you like, progressive in many ways, was very worried about the political polarization of the early 30s, late 20s and early 30s, between communism on the one hand and various forms of National Socialism or Fascism on the other. And so the documentary was invented as a third force which does not use the cinema for agitprop or propaganda uses. So its objectivity was very much designed and devised with the enemy in mind, and the enemy at that point was propaganda films, for either from the left or the right. So in that sense, it also reflects the politicization of the avant-garde, but not in the forms of the extremes of socialism, but, if you like, bourgeois liberal ideology. In that sense, documentary is the non-fiction genre that has always aspired to the status of a kind of counter-cinema. Counter-cinema to the fiction film, notably of Hollywood, but it also always wanted to be regarded as cinema. In other words, it wanted to be shown on the big screen, and it was very much committed to filmic means. And that's important if you think about the challenge of television much later. In other words, as I said, it wanted to be a counter-cinema, but it also wanted to be cinema in order not to be confused with either advertising films. By the way, many avant-garde filmmakers made their living by making advertising films for big companies. Very famous here in the Czech Republic, as you all know, I'm sure, that the Czech avant-garde got its first jobs from the Bata factory in Zlín. But documentary wanted to distinguish itself from propaganda and from advertising films. The problem of getting into the cinema was solved, or was in some ways reached a compromise after the Second World War, when most cinemas, at least in Europe, were showing documentaries as their short as a part of the short program before the feature film. So many filmmakers that we now know as feature filmmakers, for instance, the French Nouvelle Vague, Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, or the new German cinema, Edgar Reitz or Alexander Kluge, started making short documentaries, very often commissioned, but which could be shown prior to the feature film. But it was in the beginning of the 60s then that a new generation was making full-length documentaries, trying to open up a completely new way of relating to the real world. We think of the Maeslitz brothers in America, or D.A. Pennebaker, France, the anthropologist Jean Rouch. In America, one of the most famous documentary filmmakers, Fred Wiseman, still working today. Chris Marker in France. But also filmmakers made full-length documentaries who also then made feature films. It's perhaps little known that Peter Greenaway, before he became a feature filmmaker, was a documentarist working for the British Information Service. In other words, he was working for the propaganda unit of the British government and in his spare time was making documentaries. Werner Herzog, of course, very well known. Marcel Ophüls in France, one of the major documentaries. Claude Lanzmann, and so on. And these documentaries, these full-length documentaries, were always intended for theatrical release, i.e. for being shown in the cinemas. But there was a kind of inherent problem of how can you get them into cinemas. And it was really only with the emergence of documentary film festivals that these full-length feature films had their chance of being seen by a public, also being seen by critics who could write about them. But eventually, they always ended up on television. They were shown French and German television are the main public service broadcasters, at least in Western Europe. So, inherent in the documentary tradition, there's a kind of contradiction, or even a kind of double bind. You insist on making cinema, but you know you end up on television. It's, if you like, a documentary filmmaker is, in a Freudian language, constantly in denial. He knows the reality, but he has to pretend he doesn't know the reality. And that tension is a very productive one. You might say that tension could be debilitating. It could mean you can't make, you don't want to make a documentary because of this kind of paradox. But I think if you look at the history of documentary, it has actually been very productive, this tension between wanting to make cinema but knowing that you're dependent on television. And of course, since the 1980s, maybe even since the 70s in the West, since the 1980s and 90s, all documentary filmmakers are entirely dependent on television to purchase their documentaries if they're not already funding and financing their documentaries. So you have this peculiar situation that we're here at a film festival, but the documentary filmmakers here, they're not so much looking at you, to be quite honest, they're not even looking at me as member of a jury, they're looking at where are the buyers from Arte or from German television. So that is, but that's something that is typical of documentary and has been at least since the 60s. One way in which the documentary filmmakers have actually tried to solve this problem is to give their documentaries a very strong personality trait. In other words, to make documentaries that you immediately recognize as being made by an auteur. If you watch a film by Fred Wiseman, and if you know a little bit about documentaries, you'll immediately know, this is a Fred Wiseman film. Same thing goes for, let's say, a film by Harun Farocki. But what has also happened is that filmmakers, and I'll come back to that, I'll just hint at it now, have actually appeared in their films as characters. Not just as filmmakers, but as characters. The best-known example, of course, is Michael Moore, who created a persona, the fat, ignorant slob, basically, who pesters everybody with a microphone. And that is a persona. It is not the real Michael Moore. It is created, it's invented as a way of being present in his own films and to have a particular function. The same thing is true, was true, of Marcel Ophüls, the documentary filmmaker from France who became most famous with a film called Le Chagrin et la Pitié about French collaboration with the Nazi regime in the 1940s, or who made documentaries about Nazi war criminals like Klaus Barbie. And Marcel Ophüls once said, my inspiration for making documentaries was a TV series, Columbo, with Peter Falk. And when I make a documentary, I think of myself as Peter Falk. investigating. This is the, if you like, the forensic side again. And as you know, Columbo, he also plays stupid for 45 minutes out of the 50 minutes of the program. And then just as he leaves the door, he turns around and says, "One more question, madam." And then bang. And that was the technique that Marcel Ophuls appropriated for himself for documentaries. Or take an example like Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog is certainly for most of us since Grizzly Man, but well before, was always the breathless person moving into the frame and saying, "Look at this amazing sight. Have you ever seen anything like it?" So that's also a persona. That's not the real Werner Herzog. So filmmakers have actually created personas in order to identify their work as having an authorial signature. And so that's another aspect of this dilemma of, are you, as it were, on the side of the real, or are you on the side of constructedness? And so you might say that at the heart of documentary are these contradictions. These contradictions because on the one hand, recording reality and revealing the truth about a particular situation, or to allow a situation to reveal its own essence, one of the great skills and one of the great ambitions of filmmakers, namely to just be there and let something unfold, a process take its course. And on the other hand, the constant need to shape this material and to use all the tricks of the trade, and especially the tricks of fiction film, to achieve that particular shape that you want to give to a documentary. So, in order to understand this paradox, I want to refer to what I call the different subcategories or different modes or voices of documentary. And I'm using here a schema developed by another well-known American documentary scholar, whom you actually had as a guest here at Yclava, that is Bill Nichols. And Bill Nichols has suggested six different modes or voices, and these categories that he has produced or come up with have been widely used, or are widely accepted, in Anglo-American film studies courses. In other words, if you take in almost any university in the Anglo-American world a course on documentary film, it will come, you know, the lecturer or professor will use Bill Nichols' categories. First category, the poetic mode. Reassembling fragments of the world and transforming this material into more abstract, more lyrical form. A form, namely the poetic mode, which I call the formalist aspect, usually associated with the 1920s and with modernism, and modernism in the arts. So the Russian school that I mentioned, Walter Ruttmann, Len Lai, and so on, would all be part of that poetic mode. But that poetic mode was taken up again in the 60s by experimental filmmakers like Stan Brakhage, for instance, or Jonas Mekas with his diaries. So the poetic mode, although on the one hand historical, the 20s, which I called actually the mode against which documentary was invented, the agitprop films, the poetic mode has reappeared several times. For instance, Joris Evans, the Dutch filmmaker, made a very famous film called Rain. And that's a classic example of the poetic mode. Unfortunately, as I said, I can't show you an example. But the poetic mode reappears. It appeared again, as I said, with in America, with Stan Brakhage, Jonas Mekas, and the New York School. And I think we're in the process of seeing another reemergence of the poetic school, especially amongst documentary filmmakers who also have one foot in the world of galleries and installation art. So the poetic mode is a consistent mode that shows most clearly the hand and the intervention of the filmmaker, and which abstracts from the primary material. The second mode of that Bill Nichols has come up with is the expository mode. The expository mode would encompass much of the classic documentaries from the 30s, where you had voiceover commentary. All the famous films that made during the Depression and the New Deal in America would be expository mode. It has a narrator. It tries to convey information in the form of a story. But one of the dangers of the expository mode is that the images are simply used to illustrate an argument already constituted in advance. And so it is a mode, the expository mode, that was very heavily criticized after the Second World War, even though it was still used. Think of one of the most famous documentaries of all time, Alain René's Night and Fog, is expository insofar that there is a voiceover, voice of commentary. But the voice of commentary is very poetic. It was written by a poet, Jean Cayrol, and it lets the images speak for themselves while the commentary speaks also about something else but related, so that you as the viewer constantly have to make the connection between what you see in the images and what you hear on the soundtrack, rather than the soundtrack telling you how to view the images and how to interpret the images. But the expository mode, even of the kind that Alain René or then Chris Marker used. Again, if you think of one of the most famous films of Chris Marker, Sans Soleil, it has a voiceover commentary, but the voiceover commentary is itself a kind of narrative, a separate narrative about correspondence, about talking with a woman. In other words, it's very displaced in relationship to the images. So it's the tension between the words and the image that rescues the expository mode in the 1960s and 70s. But there was a major reaction against the expository mode, and that would be the observational mode. And the observational mode is what's also sometimes called the fly on the wall mode. In other words, where the camera makes itself as invisible as possible and pretends that it's not there. And I say pretends that it's not there. But documentary filmmakers have developed a huge number of techniques in order to disguise the practice or the fact that they are actually filming an event. For instance, you know, they in the environment or the group that they are concerned with, they use a week or 2 weeks beforehand, and they just have the camera. So to get all their subjects used to the presence of a camera or a crew. And then they often either film or don't film. They never let the subjects know when they're actually filming. So the observational mode, while it is in one sense the most realistic mode, the most transparent mode, is actually also one of the most constructed mode, because it lives by the fiction that the camera isn't there. So we come back to the paradoxical or contradictory nature of documentary in its essence. The observational mode also goes by the name of direct cinema or cinema vérité, although there are distinctions, and I unfortunately don't have the time to go into them. But for our purposes, I could say that the most celebrated, because the most impressive, documentary filmmaker of the observational mode is still Fred Wiseman. But Fred Wiseman, very often in his films, almost with all his films, focuses on a group of people, a community. But behind or through the group of people, whether this is in films like High School or Basic Training or Law and Order or Titicut Follies, By focusing on a group of people, he always wants to analyze an institution. And that is his genius. His genius is to confront us or to make us live among a group of people. School teachers, police officers, people in a mental institution, people slaughtering cattle, all kinds of, or in the army. And he just focuses on a group of people that we come to recognize and come to live with, as it were, over a period of time. But then you gradually realize that through these people, Wiseman critiques an institution and shows how much our everyday life is formed by the invisible presence of the pressures of institutions. And Wiseman, whose work comes from the 60s and 70s, is very parallel as a filmmaker to what Michel Foucault is in the world of ideas, namely showing how institutionally we're disciplined without realizing the pressure of institutions. So even though, as I said, the observational mode has become rather suspect, the work of Frederick Wiseman will survive. It is one of the great works of the 20th century as a body of work. There's another subcategory of the observational mode, and that is the long-time observation. In other words, where a filmmaker accompanies the same group over many years. Michael Apted famously has accompanied people. Every 7 years, he goes back to the same people and shows us what has become of their lives. And he's done that now 4 or 5 times. So he started when they were children of 7, and they're now in their 60s. And that's one of the most extraordinary records of human lives over a long period of time. And especially in, I think I'm right in saying in Eastern Europe, certainly in East Germany, a lot of observational long-term films have been made that are now a kind of record of a disappearing world. You know, they are one of the most valuable documents of the real existing socialism. So whatever you might say about the observational mode in its kind of problematic aspects, it has actually produced some of the very great works of the documentary tradition, just as the expository mode also has produced great masterpieces. As a reaction to the observational mode came the participatory mode, where the encounter of the filmmaker with the subject is part of the film. Whether that is, as I said, in the form of interviews, like Marcel Offul's films, or in the form of the subjects of the film being able to talk back to the camera, or any other variation of these forms of participating, allowing, for instance, the subjects to participate in shaping the documentary material. So the participatory mode wants to make you, the audience, aware that this is indeed a construction. And it's out of that awareness of a construction comes a greater sense of authenticity if you suspect that the observational mode, where the camera completely disappears and denies itself, is somehow fake without or has problems in asserting its authenticity, because we know there is an invisible camera, as indeed there is in fiction films. So the participatory mode became prominent in the 70s and 80s. Bowling for Columbine would be a very good example, but also the films of, as I already mentioned, Werner Herzog, Les Blanks, Ross McKelvey, and others. Those were the original four modes that Bill Nichols put in the discussion, but he then added two more. One, what he calls the reflexive mode, And that is, if you like, an aggravation or an intensification of the participatory mode, where the filmmaker actually raises issues of representation, about real, is it real, is it fiction, to what extent am I intervening in the events, am I staging some of the aspects of the story I'm telling, am I reenacting an incident that I wasn't there to film. So the reflexive mode may be called, for instance, maybe associated with filmmakers like the early films of Krzysztof Kieślowski, when Kieślowski was still making documentaries, or the Chilean filmmaker Raul Ruiz, or films that are now often categorized as film essays or essay films, like the films of Harun Farocki, or more recently Abbas Kiarostami has made documentaries in this particular reflexive mode, where the difference between documentary and fiction is also in doubt. And of course, Chris Marker would be the reflexive mode, again somebody you may have come across in the context of the essay film. And then we have finally the performative mode. And the performative mode goes furthest in using techniques borrowed from fiction. It acknowledges the emotional and subjective aspect of a documentary. It presents ideas as part of a context. In other words, it does actually deal with quite abstract issues. It acknowledges that sometimes you're not present, and therefore you are allowed, or you want to use reconstructions, reenactments. And perhaps the most successful and important filmmaker of this particular performative mode is Errol Morris, of The Thin Blue Line, Fast, Cheap and Out of Control. And the performative mode already blends into the fake documentary, or the documentary where the filmmaker leaves you in doubt as to why or what you're seeing, how real is it, how much is invented. And so the performative mode brings me to the last part of my paper, namely the contemporary challenges. And I'll be very brief about those. And I said there are three challenges. First of all, there's the institutional challenge of how does documentary filmmakers deal with television. As I said, and I've already in a way discussed that, the problem that the documentary filmmaker has, that he still considers himself or herself as making cinema. And the tension is now between television as a public service broadcasting institution, as we have that in Western countries, especially in France and Germany, less so in Great Britain, although you still have the BBC, not at all in Italy. I'm not terribly well informed about Central and Eastern Europe. But television is the main guardian now, paradoxically, of the documentary or public service broadcasting is the main guardian of the ethics and the aesthetics of documentary film. And there's a particular, if you like, cooperation, model of cooperation between film festivals, not just a documentary film festival, also other film festivals. Cannes shows documentaries, Rotterdam shows documentaries, Berlin shows documentaries. In other words, there's a particular kind of alliance or compromise formation between documentary filmmakers and festivals on the one hand, and documentary festivals and public service broadcasters on the other. Whether this is going to last, I don't know. But this is one of the challenges that documentary filmmakers face, because very few documentaries manage to get a cinematic release. We had Michael Moore and we had Werner Herzog with Grizzly Man, but you know, and Errol Morris perhaps with one or two of his films. But you really, you know, if in any given year two or three documentaries make it into general release, that would be a big success. So documentary is still dependent on television. The second challenge, as I said, is the one about what I call the political profile of documentary. The whole documentary ethos, as I've tried to explain, is to hold a middle course between propaganda and advertising. But at the same time, to be committed to progressive ideals. That is why documentaries are so heavily involved in human rights, in creating better conditions, in critiquing abuses of power, and so on. But documentaries, for most of its life, has lived from the possibility of some kind of radical change. In other words, that the documentaries contribute to changing the world, by documenting the world, by letting reality reveal itself. It fosters the impulses towards change. And the great danger now that we live in a time when there does not seem to be any alternative to the liberal capitalist mode of production or even the model of society, where does the documentarist take the progressive ideas from? And the great danger is that documentaries become purely critical, purely negative, or purely nostalgic. That they simply bewail or mourn that which is past. Now, documentary has a very important function as being the memory of a civilization or the memory of a culture. But if you strictly follow the history of documentary, you realize that there has always been this impulse towards improving the lot of mankind. In other words, you could say documentary film is one of the most potent legacies of the European Enlightenment. In other words, that if you know that something is wrong, you will have the energies and the resolution to change it. And that belief that by knowing something to be wrong, we can change something, that belief is now in huge crisis. And I think that crisis is reflected in documentary film today. And especially here in Central and Eastern Europe, where the pain, the phantom pain of the disappointment, the betrayal, and the sheer tragedy of having lived under a regime that failed in all its promises is particularly acute, and so is the danger of becoming purely nostalgic about the good old days, which weren't so good, and about the cynicism or the depressiveness about the present situation. Then, finally, my third challenge has to do with digitization and the internet. And I don't mean, although I could talk for a long time, about how the digital image is, of course, a contradiction in terms when applied to documentary, because documentary has primarily lived off the authentication of the material. In other words, that which we see in a documentary once really physically existed in time and space in front of the camera. Now, as you know, this in technical jargon is called the indexicality of the photographic image. Now, of course, with digital images, you do not have this indexicality. And so, what intervenes, and I think what actually ought to make us rethink whole of the cinematic documentary tradition, is that documentaries are not about truth. They're about trust. And that's a big difference between truth and trust. They're about the kind of contract that the filmmaker establishes with the audience. Namely, that the filmmaker is able to tell you within a couple of minutes of the film that he or she is truthful, only in the sense that they do their best to rely on the evidence before them. Or that they say to you, watch out, don't trust me. I am giving you my version of the world. Or in the case of Errol Morris, who says, I do not film documentaries, I document lies. And I think that is a very powerful way of putting the contemporary situation of documentary filmmakers. I do not make documentaries, I document lies. And so trust doesn't actually mean necessarily or only that a filmmaker keeps to what are called felicity conditions. That is, a filmmaker lets the audience know that he is truthful, he does his best, and so on. A filmmaker can also say, I'm a clown, I'm performing a role. In other words, as long as the filmmaker makes it clear to the audience what kind of contract he or she has with the audience, the scope of documentaries expands to include fake documentaries, mockumentaries, doc fictions, and so on. So the important thing is what I call trust rather than truth, but trust is a function of distrust and skepticism rather than naive belief. But there's also trust, very important aspect of the whole tradition of documentary filmmaking, the trust between the filmmaker and his or her subjects. In other words, that we as an audience feel that the filmmaker respects the people that he or she works with, interviews, represents. And this again distinguishes documentaries, well, actually distinguishes good from bad documentaries, and distinguishes documentaries from television reality or television reportage. Because television doesn't always, in fact very rarely, have that kind of trust with its subject. It doesn't have the time, has other motives. And I would say that what television does with real people, it harvests them. It harvests them like crops. It harvests them, harvests their emotions. So whenever there's a natural disaster or war, what happens? A television crew goes out and films some woman crying and saying, oh, I lost my son, whatever. In other words, television takes real people and simply skims the emotional reaction to whatever happens to be there. And that is like, you know, as I said, like harvesting a crop when it's ripe, ripe for emotional reaction. And that too is one of the great dangers of documentary in the digital age, if you like. On the one hand, as I said, it's the competition from amateurs, for people who just put anything that happens to them on YouTube. And on the other hand, it is that because of their close proximity to television, that documentary filmmakers are also tempted to use their subjects and harvest their stories, harvest their emotions, harvest their lives, and they say, thank you, and out of the way. And so for the documentary tradition, it's not so much, you know, what makes them authentic is not so much, you know, that indexicality of the photographic image. It's the two kinds of trusts. Trust in the relationship with the audience and trust in relationship with the subject. And so one of the, if you like, and that's my concluding words, one of the things we need to be aware of is that reality is now a commodity like any other commodity. And television is processing it, processing the real, but it's also, as I said, a kind of factory of the real. And that means that in that close alliance that television now has with documentary and documentary filmmakers have with public broadcasting institutions, the great danger or the unanswered question is, how does documentary survive? How does it reinvent itself in the face of the fact that reality is now not necessarily something that reveals itself? After all, much of reality is already pre-constituted through the presence of cameras and images in all aspects of our daily lives, in politics, in our private lives, through camcorders, family snapshots, holiday movies, and in politics, and in public life, big screens everywhere, urban spaces completely pervaded with images. So there isn't really a way of getting to the truth unless you treat reality like some rare metal. And I think a lot of documentaries that you see try to find the little spots like where there is still untouched human reality. In other words, rather like nature films, you know, where you go to the Amazon rainforest to find some species, or you go to Papua New Guinea because there's still a beach that hasn't been colonized with high-rise hotels. So reality is now an endangered biotope. It's now an endangered area. It's a rare material that, again, documentaries are tempted to harvest. But of course, by harvesting, they're destroying it. So television, but also cinema, you know, documentary film, is involved in another paradox, perhaps the most fragile treacherous paradox, namely that which it discovers, that which it reveals, it also destroys in the very process of discovering and preserving. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, because